Coming up on Harvard Chan This Week in Health, a new travel warning for pregnant women amid rising concerns over the Zika virus. Plus, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. We take a closer look at the dangers posed by lead pipes across the country. And the science of concussions. As the NFL gears up for conference championship weekend, you'll hear from one expert who's studying the impact of head injuries. Welcome to Harvard Chan This Week in Health. I'm Amy Montemiro.
And I'm Noah Levitt. And topping our news this week, Amy, the Centers for Disease Control is warning pregnant women not to travel to more than a dozen countries across Latin America and the Caribbean amid growing concern over the Zika virus. That list includes Brazil, Mexico, and Puerto Rico.
And Noah, the new warning comes after several pregnant women in the U.S. tested positive for Zika virus. There has been a spike in cases of the mosquito-borne illness in recent months, most notably in Brazil, which has seen more than 3,500 cases since October.
Zika infections in pregnancy are linked to an increased risk of babies being born with microcephaly, a condition that causes smaller than normal heads, brain damage, and developmental delays. And there is an additional concern. The WHO reports increasing evidence that Zika infections can trigger Guillain-Barré syndrome, a temporary form of paralysis. Right now, there's no vaccine for Zika, so if you are traveling to one of the affected countries, you're urged to take precautions to prevent mosquito bites, such as covering exposed skin and using insect repellent.
Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder is under fire this week over his administration's response to the water crisis in Flint.
Lead contamination in that city has rendered the water undrinkable and not safe for cooking or bathing children. And our newly released emails show that state officials were slow to respond to the crisis.
And Noah, problems began after state officials switched the source of the city's water from Lake Huron to less expensive water from the Flint River. The Flint River's more corrosive water caused lead to leach from aging pipes and into the drinking water. Residents in Flint say they complained for months about the water, reporting a foul odor and strange color before officials took any action.
And Flint is not the first American city to deal with contaminated water. 15 years ago in Washington, D.C., a corrosive water supply caused lead to seep into tap water there. The nation's capital managed to address the issue by treating their water so it would be less corrosive as it flowed through pipes. We spoke about this with Philippe Grandjean, adjunct professor of environmental health at the Harvard Chan School. He says the issue is hard to address simply because there are so many lead pipes in the United States. In Europe, most lead pipes have been removed, but doing so in the U.S. would be expensive and difficult.
Virtually every community has lead pipes. It's a cheap and useful, malleable material. For technical reasons, this is extremely useful, and so it has been used all over. Usually, we just control the water quality at the community water supply, and we don't test it at the consumer level. And it's oftentimes the thinner pipes that lead from the community water lines into the buildings and inside the buildings. Those are oftentimes made of lead. That could make it very, very tricky to have all those pipes removed. I think this is an illustration that we should heed the warnings, because in the long term, we're going to have to pay dearly if we don't heed those warnings.
Grandjean said that even if the issues with the water supply are fixed, there will be long-term consequences for the children of Flint. Evidence has shown that lead exposure can cause an increased risk of cognitive deficits, ADHD, and other serious ailments. Michigan's governor has pledged $28 million to help Flint respond to the crisis. That's in addition to $5 million pledged by the Obama administration. But estimates are that the cost of repairing the corroded pipes in Flint may exceed $1 billion. The CDC this week is issuing new guidance to doctors hoping to reduce the overuse of antibiotics.
Noah, this is all part of a growing effort to combat the rising threat of drug-resistant infections. Repeated exposure to antibiotics can cause some bacteria to become resistant to drugs. The CDC estimates that drug-resistant bacteria cause 2 million illnesses and more than 20,000 deaths each year in the U.S.
And Amy, that's why doctors are now being urged to be more cautious before prescribing antibiotics for acute respiratory infections, illnesses such as cold or sinus infections. We spoke about the new recommendations with Bill Hannage, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Harvard Chan School. He says it's a good step to take as doctors and scientists out of a complex and growing problem.
Just think about the number of times you or a member of your family has gone to the doctor's office with a cold or a sinus infection or an ear infection, and you can see that this is a very, very big group of diseases that you might go to your doctor and might expect to get an antibiotic prescribed for. What we are trying to do is make sure that the antibiotics are really only being used when they're absolutely necessary. Antibiotics are not in and of themselves drugs that you want to be taking if you don't need to be. They have side effects. They can mess around with a whole bunch of other things, including all the bacteria that live in your gut that you need in order to live a healthy life. So you might want to avoid that, especially if there's no evidence that the antibiotics actually work. What you can do instead is treat the symptoms. That's taking something like acetaminophen or other things which will bring down a fever. A study that was done by the Wellcome Trust found that a lot of people thought that when people talked about antibiotic resistance, it was the person who was becoming resistant to antibiotics, not the bacteria that were infecting them, which, you know, it is not the case. These are infections which are resistant to drugs, and we find it more and more difficult to treat them. And there's a really simple message. If we don't do something about this, people are going to get sick with things that we are not going to be able to treat, and more people will die from it.
Hannage also notes that a major contributor to the rise of drug-resistant infections is the use of antibiotics in livestock.
Drug overdoses are leading to a spike in deaths among young white adults in the U.S. That's according to a New York Times analysis of 60 million death certificates. Death rates for men and women between 25 and 34 years old have risen more than 20% since 1999. The increases have been greatest for those without a high school education, and a main driver has been drug overdoses, with both illegal and prescription drugs. The Times reports that the overdose death rate for young whites in 2014 was five times the level in 1999. The rate for whites 35 to 44 years old tripled during that same period. The spike in the death rate for whites comes as a death rate for blacks and Hispanics has fallen over the past 15 years. And finally in this episode, it's conference championship weekend in the NFL.
That's right, Amy. In the AFC, the New England Patriots face the Denver Broncos looking to return to the Super Bowl. And the NFC, the Arizona Cardinals will take on the Carolina Panthers.
And as this NFL season nears its end, the league continues to face questions and criticism related to concussions and the health of its players.
And so researchers at Harvard are among those now investigating the effects of football injuries. We spoke to Bill Meehan, who is the Associate Director of the Football Players Health Study, which is a wide-ranging project that has completed interviews with thousands of former pros.
The Football Players Health Study is about assessing the health of former NFL players over their whole lives, not just the injuries they sustain on the field, but also the medical conditions that affect them throughout their whole lives. There's three sort of main components that all feed into each other. So the first place we started was by collecting data from players, and so far well over 2,500 have given us information about the medical problems that they face, the injuries they've sustained, the surgeries they've had, the medications they take, etc. From that data, we are dispatching throughout Harvard investigators to focus on areas that are important to players and also medical conditions that are relatively prevalent among the respondents. We use that data to sort of invent new treatments, prevention measures, new ways of diagnosing and improving their quality of life. And more than just their biological health, we're also assessing the structures and social settings that affect their health, including the demands on them while they play, the period in from which they transition from being sort of world-famous NFL players to not being players any longer, how those things also affect their health.
The fact that you're working directly with these players is pretty unique. How important is that to your research, and has your work with the players inspired you to direct your research into any new or unexpected areas?
We thought that the potential effects of repetitive head trauma would be something that they'd be interested in. It turns out that while it is, they are perhaps even more interested in musculoskeletal injuries and the prevention of tearing their ACL, because that interferes with their ability to play, and even if they can get back to play, often they don't play at the same level. They are concerned about long-term musculoskeletal injuries like osteoarthritis, that of course is they suffer an increased risk of that, particularly if they tear their ACL and sustain other injuries. I think, you know, the general public, including investigators, sort of think we know what the priority studies are, but here the football players are telling us.
You're focusing a lot of research on concussions and the impact of repetitive head injuries. What's the state of that research?
Quite frankly, nobody was really interested in concussion until recently. You know, in the 1980s and 90s, there was a few physicians mostly saying, hey, we should take this a little more seriously. They were ignored. A lot of times they were directly ridiculed, publicly ridiculed. So it's really been the last sort of 10, 15 years that people sort of shifted their focus to it. And as a result, we don't know a ton. Here at Harvard, we're approaching it in several different ways. We have several investigators who are using animal models to try and determine what is the basic fundamental pathophysiology of concussion? What does it directly lead to? What might be things that it can indirectly lead to? And how can you prevent long-term problems from it? And then we have larger studies trying to assess the effects of concussion, but also maybe trauma to the brain that doesn't lead to the symptoms of concussion and whether or not that can have any long-term effects. And then finally, we're looking at potential treatments for concussion. Ideally, we would prevent it, but for people who have already sustained a concussion or perhaps have what they believe are long-term effects from repeated concussion, are there ways to treat it and improve their symptoms?
How do you see the results of this research, especially regarding concussions, being translated to other sports?
Concussions in football get a lot of attention, but the truth is the incidence, the sort of risk of concussion, is nearly as high, maybe higher, depending on which study you look at, in ice hockey, which of course is very popular around here. If you look at combat sports like boxing and ultimate fighting, concussions are sometimes that's the objective, right? You concuss the other guy, you win. If you look at soccer in particular, you know, there's an enormous number of athletes playing soccer. In fact, if you look worldwide, there's such a higher number of people playing soccer that it is likely the source of more concussions than American football because there's so many more people playing it.
What are some of the trends you're seeing with regards to concussion prevention, both in football and other sports?
You know, I think unfortunately some of the trends are bucking the science, and so people are instituting rules and equipment prematurely, and we don't really know what the effects of that are going to be. There is an effort to prevent it. I think that's good. Certainly some things are just plain sound. Reducing the number of contact practices and the number of contact drills is going to reduce the number of impacts to the head, and there's really no downside to that. People ought to do that. Some people are talking about perhaps delaying the age at which you hit a soccer ball until later in life. Quite honestly, I think that's a potential mistake. You know, hitting a soccer ball demands a lot of timing, a lot of skill, a lot of coordination. And I think you're probably safer learning that when you're relatively young and the ball is coming at you at slower speeds than trying to learn it when you're older and the guy on the other side can kick with a lot of force. I understand the concern, but I think it's dangerous to wait until an athlete's 14, 15 years old. All of a sudden, they're jumping in front of a soccer ball. You know, perhaps a better way to do it would be to train them with a Nerf ball or something a little bit less massive so that they can develop the timing and the coordination and all the necessary skills without necessarily the risk of force. But even then, we really ought to look at what is the best way and what are the dangers of doing these things.
Has doing this research changed at all how you feel about football or maybe how you watch football?
Like all people, when I was young, I sort of enjoyed the big hits and the sort of physicality of the game. I still enjoy the physicality of it, but I don't like the big hits. I certainly don't like the hits of a defensive player. The helmet-to-helmet hits drive me crazy. There's really no need for it. And if you use other sports like rugby and ice hockey as an example, a cheap shot to the head of a defenseless player will get you ejected from the game. In ice hockey, you get a game misconduct. In rugby, you get a red card. In American football, most of the time, you get a 15-yard penalty. There is a rule on the books that the referee can throw a player out at his discretion. I've never in my life seen that happen. I think a lot of these cheap shots ought to result in expulsion from the game. Head-to-head collisions are should absolutely be banned. Head-to-head collisions in rugby are rare. And the reason is the players are not wearing a helmet. And, of course, the scalp is highly sensitive. You hit your scalp and it hurts. Once you put a helmet on, all of a sudden you don't feel that pain. And so the temptation is to use your head as a driving force or the end of a battering ram. And more than that, to put it in risky situations where you wouldn't if it hurt. There's really no need for it in football, and actually it should just be banned. The second thing is the hit of a defenseless player. A lot of times there's a guy going for a ball. He sort of extends at the body. His eyes are on the ball to make the catch. Player comes up out of nowhere and hammers him. You'll make the highlight reel doing that. You probably get a big reaction from the crowd. But the truth is the goal of the game is to put him on the ground to prevent him from advancing the football. It's not to injure the player. There's just no need for that.
That was Bill Meehan talking about research into the health of football players. And Amy, Meehan mentioned that researchers from the Football Players Health Study recently published some interesting findings related to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, a neurodegenerative condition linked to repetitive head trauma.
The development of CTE has been tied to a misshapen version of the tau protein, but Harvard researchers say that they were able to develop an antibody that could selectively target and destroy the toxic protein. The findings could one day prove helpful for football players and also potentially prove useful for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease.
So a lot of evolving science in this area, and again, another story that we'll probably be following closely for the next few years. That's all for Harvard Chan This Week in Health. I'm Noah Levitt.
And I'm Amy Montemiro. You can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes U, just search for Harvard University, or you can find it on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/Harvard Public Health. And as always, you can visit hsph.harvard.edu to stay up to date on the latest health news.